Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder, a founder that has been pushing his business for over 16 years now, you know, incredible impact that he's had. And we're going to be talking about all good stuff, you know, like, for example, finding your customer first, figuring out the product market fit, then also having an impact, you know, with what you're doing. I mean, in their case, they have invested $400 million into many areas that they have produced an incredible impact with, 2,000 employees, 142 branches, and on and on. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Arun Kumar Padmanabhan. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, very nice to be here.
Originally born in Chennai, south of India. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, Chennai is a pretty traditional city. And I come from a very traditional Indian family, very conservative. My father worked in financial services. My mother was mostly a homemaker. We are very religious family, traditional Hindu family. Yeah, so that, and my school focused very heavily on academics, less on sports and extracurriculars. So pretty standard upbringing in a South Indian traditional family. I did my entire schooling and my college undergraduation in Chennai before moving to a city called Pune in Western India to do law. So I qualified as a lawyer, after graduating in Chennai.
Now, in your case, you know, like, why law out of all things?
My goal was to work in corporate and commercial law and in banking. That's the intent with which I started, pursuing law as a career. And I knew at that point that I would want to do something in financial services, entrepreneurial at some point. And I thought banking would be a doorway to do that. I saw law and corporate commercial banking law as a doorway to entering banking. Yeah.
Now, talk to us about that shift that happened, you know, because directly you joined a bank, you know, and you were there for a few years, you know, for about 6 years. But how did the opportunity of the bank come about? You know, because it's a little bit different from, you know, the traditional path that a lawyer, you know, would follow of joining a law firm or opening your own practice. So how did the whole opportunity of the bank, you know, come knocking?
Yeah, so while I was studying law, I pursued an internship specifically in the bank because it was my intention to, work in financial services. I went and did an internship on my final year of law in a bank, and I got a pre-placement offer from them, and I joined them soon after I graduated. Yeah, that's how I started working in the bank.
And you were there for about 6 years. Yeah.
Yeah, and in the 6 years, I had great exposure in that bank. It was India's largest private sector bank at that point, and I was part of a core team of that bank that set up international banking for that bank. So it had this bank, which is called ICICI Bank, at that point had only operations in India. And in 2002, they decided that they should go global. And I was part of the team that set up international banking for them. So my work was to be part of that team, and I was providing legal support. So which means I went to many countries. Figured out what is the best strategy for this bank in that country. In some countries, we set up a wholesale bank. In some countries, we set up a consumer bank. In some countries, we set up, a wealth management business. So depending on what would, the local laws and licenses would permit for us and, what type of strategic fit we saw, we set up different businesses in different countries. It was It is a business that grew from zero to $5 billion in the 5 years that I was associated with it. So it was quite exciting to see that growth. And this is what happened between, 2002 and 2007, during the time that I was in this bank.
Yeah. So the whole social economic, or the social developmental, type of sector, how did you start to create that interest towards it? Because that obviously resulted in a meeting with the Susan and Michael Dell Foundation, which was pivotal for you. But how did you start to really develop that interest around the area?
Well, while I was working in this bank, I was also volunteering with a few nonprofit organizations in Mumbai. While I was based in Mumbai, and I used to travel international a lot, and I was volunteering with an organization called Aid India, which had chapter in Mumbai, and it also had chapter in many other countries. It was basically a students' organization of Indian expatriate students. Students from India who went abroad to study had formed this organization to help grassroots movements in India and to help low-income communities in India. So this was the purpose of that organization. I was a volunteer with that organization based in Mumbai, and I had worked with them in slums in Mumbai. So I had some exposure to slum communities in Mumbai, and I understood their way of life, some of the challenges that they face. And I was only a volunteer, really. I didn't do a lot of, very active work. But in 2005 in Mumbai, there were huge floods that happened because of, very massive rains. And I was part of relief and rehabilitation work in slums in Mumbai. And somewhere between 2005 and 2006, as I was involved in all of this, I started feeling the need to try and make that part of my career in some way. And I was very dissatisfied because, my volunteering work was impacted because of my work and travel. And I was not very happy with what I was able to accomplish. And somewhere I started feeling if there was an opportunity to do that as a full-time career, that would be good. But then my background was financial services. And I was always thinking in terms of, being in banking as a career. So somewhere I thought if there's an opportunity to work in an entrepreneurial initiative that will involve financial services associated with low-income population, that might all bring various things that I together motivate me. So it was at this stage that I started exploring an entrepreneurial initiative in social development space in general. And the first person that I met was someone from the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, who said that if I were to set up a microfinance company that would work in slums in Mumbai, then they were willing to provide a small grant support to it. So that sounded exactly like what I should be doing, because it aligned with my priorities of being in financial services, being in banking, and also working with low income communities. All of these things came together in that proposal, and so I took that opportunity and started this company called Swasti, along with my partner Narayanan. So the two of us are co-founders of this company, and we set up Swasti. After I left the bank in 2007, it took me a year to set it up, and we started lending in 2008.
What were the early days like?
Right at the beginning, we started this as a not-for-profit initiative, simply because we did not have the minimum capital that's required to set up a regulated financial institution to do this business as a commercial or a for-profit initiative. So our strategy was to demonstrate that this is a viable business opportunity, that is microfinance in urban slums in Mumbai, particularly. We wanted to establish that this is a viable business. And we decided to do it in a non-profit framework and set it up to a certain size and scale. And that's exactly what we did between 2008 and 2010. It took us about close to 2 years to build a small portfolio and to demonstrate that this is indeed working, that it is viable, that the people who are borrowing are indeed repaying. We had 100% repayment record during this period. We built a very small portfolio of about something in the range of about $200,000 to $250,000, touching about close to 3,000 borrowers. And as we did that, we were able to go to commercial private equity or venture capital investors and prove to them that this model indeed works and we are capable of scaling it up. And we also built the base technology for this business ground up and built a team. So using this team and the technology and the sort of incubation accomplishment of about roughly $250,000 of portfolio, we prospected and raised commercial capital for this business and made it into a for-profit business in the year 2010.
How difficult is it to go from a non-for-profit to a for-profit? How difficult is that transition?
For us, the transition was easy simply because this is what we had planned for. You know, it was fairly straightforward. Because once we had commitment from investors that they would invest into the for-profit business, then all we had to do was we created an entity, and got a license. Effectively, we acquired an entity with a license, and we moved the for-profit non-profit business into the for-profit business. And that was a fairly quick process. It just took about 5-6 months overall. But once we had the commitments from the investors, it is just a matter of routine transition. So that transition itself was quite simple. And anyway, it was always our intention to set up a large, scalable, sustainable, profitable, and a high impact company. This is what our goal was. So right from the beginning. So it was just a step in that path.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Svasti? How do you guys make money?
So what we do is basically we borrow money from banks and institutions in India and abroad. And we also use our own capital. So we raise capital. Based on the capital, we borrow money. And using this pool of resources, we lend we lend to only women who are in the low income segment in India. So typically, our customer is somebody who has a monthly income that could range from about, about $125 to $400. This is the broad range, I would say. We are servicing a customer whose household income is in the range of $125 to $400. And what we are doing is we are giving them loans. These are women entrepreneurs who are running some small business that is giving them an income of $125 to $400 in that range. And what we are doing is we are providing working capital financing, or we are providing financing which they use, to build something, for associated with their business. More than 90% of our loans go to, for business purposes, some sort of business or commercial activity that they are running. And we typically have repeat borrowers. So once we make a loan to a woman, she then, would repay that loan in a period of 12 to 24 months. So typically our loan duration is 12 to 24 months, and in this time she's taken the loan from us and she starts paying us back in EMIs, equated monthly installments. We do either weekly collection or monthly collection, So some of them are paying us every week. Some of them are paying us every month. And in a period of 12 to 24 months, their loan is finished. And then a good number of them then come and take a second loan from us. So we have a 70% plus renewal rate and so on and so forth. So this is what we do. And to the woman herself, this loan is completely unsecured. So there is no security. But we encourage her to form a group of typically five women who come together. And these ladies know each other quite well. They know, and they are neighbors. They live near each other, and they are aware of what's going on in each other's house and each other's businesses, because they are also friends and neighbors, and they are willing to guarantee each other. So because we don't have any collateral or security from them, and this is also a segment where it's very difficult to very perfectly assess the income of these households, because largely it's undocumented income. They are all earning in cash and spending in cash. But even if you can assess that income quite accurately, it's a small income, $125 to $400. And typically, the model involves five of them guaranteeing each other and giving us the assurance that if one of them is not able to repay, the other four will support and pay her installments. And with the support of this credit guarantee and a mutual guarantee of these five women, we make a loan to each of them. Our average loan amount $100 is $8,000. It's about $500. Yeah, we lend about $500 to each woman. That's the average loan that we make. So the range of the loan varies from $500 to about $1,200 per woman. So five of them come together and take this loan, and then they repay over 12 to 24 months. And at the end of this tenure, after they fully repay, they can come and they are eligible to take a higher loan. So the people who have taken $500, the next loan, they can take $700, and so on and so forth. So this is the essence of our model. So the income that we make is the interest difference between our borrowing rate and the lending rate. So this is the difference, the income that we make. And this income has to go towards meeting all our expenses, because it's a very people-intensive business, because the process of assessing the income and running the operations, of course, there is a very strong technology element to it, but equally there is a people element to it. So the cost of the people, the infrastructure, the technology, all of that is part of our operating expenses, which has to be funded by the income that we make. And apart from that, there are some amount of credit losses, loan losses, which also we have to fund using the income that we make. So broadly, and of course, we have to pay our lenders, whoever pay us. So basically, the income that we make goes to repay our lenders. It meets our operating expenses and covers the losses that we make, credit costs. And on top of it, we make some profit. So that's broadly the model. But not only this, we also provide other financial services to the women. One of the services we provide is a medical insurance facility. So this is also a segment which is very vulnerable to medical emergencies, and the cost of meeting a medical emergency is quite high for them, because they are running daily businesses. You imagine, if one day they are not opening their shop and running that business, they don't have income for that day. So they don't have any social security or any other support system. So if somebody's sick and they have to be medically hospitalized for that many days, of course, they have to suffer the medical expenses. Also, the business doesn't run. If a key earning member is incapacitated, the business doesn't run and the house doesn't make any income. So we have a medical insurance that we provide for a small fee. Insurance premium, we provide them what is called a hospicash coverage, which gives them a daily income support or something like 3,000 rupees in Indian terms, which is about, $40 per day of hospitalization. If somebody is in the hospital for 4 or 5 days, then, 40 into 5, say $200 is paid to them, which supports them, through the days that they are incapacitated.
And what about you guys too? I mean, how have you guys financed the operation and capitalized the business?
So we have equity in the business. We have raised about $20 million overall in equity over and above that, we have made some accumulated profits over the years. So that's this is called our net worth of our business, right? And using this net worth, we have borrowed. So overall, you know, our net worth, I mean, just in Indian rupee terms, currently is about 220 crores, which is roughly $30 million, somewhere around $27-28 million. That's the amount of net worth we have. And against this net worth, we have borrowed about $100 million, you know, overall. And we have used this pool of capital of both the net worth and the borrowing to make loans to our customers. So our portfolio is about 1,200 crore or in Indian rupee terms, which is about $125-130 million, which is funded by the $110 million of borrowing and about $28 million of net worth.
So in total, how much have you financed in loans? Is it about 400 million, or how much have you financed?
So the 450 million is something that is all the loans we have made since 2008.
Okay.
You know, the loans that we have made and repaid and made and repaid and repaid, that the aggregate of all of that is about $450 million, right? And but the current outstanding of the loans that we have made totally will be about $130 million. What is outstanding as of now of 425,000 borrowers and $130 million, yes.
Okay. Now, for you guys, you've been able to scale the operation nicely. You have over 2,000 employees in 142 branches. How has it been to the journey of scaling this business on the human capital side?
So this business is a people-centric business. You know, while there's a very strong technology element to this, you know, the contact with the borrowers is primarily with our team. So we have each of our branches have 10 employees who are meeting and closely engaging with around 4,000 borrowers. So 4,000 borrowers are in touch with these 10 employees practically. You know, they are practically meeting them very often as well to do collection activity, and they are sourcing loans. So the same team does both the loan sourcing as well as the loan collection. It's very important to have the right type of employees. You know, our employees are also very similar to in profile to our customers. Who are with a very basic high school education, you know, and with no college education, people who speak local languages, who come from the same community as our borrowers. So even our employees come from a household that are earning between, I would say, $100 to $400 a month. From a segment that's very similar to our customers. So we have a very rigorous training, you know, strategy and a training process that to put them into training and to make sure that they have all the skills that they need to do customer engagement, customer assessment, credit assessment, and all the activities that are associated with our process and how they use our technology. So we train them very rigorously. We also provide very good career progress for them. This is something that we do very well. Our values are called people first. This is our values. Which means we build with keeping our people at the front and center of our business. So you will find in our company a very vast majority of people who have been with us and joined us at entry level and who have scaled up their career for multiple promotions and have become middle management and senior management staff. So we are very focused on that. We are what is called a Great Place to Work certified company 4 times in a row. You know, there's an institution that certifies human resources practices in companies, you know, across the world and in India as well. And we have their certification. So we are very focused on making sure that Swasti is a great workplace and Swasti provides a fantastic career progress opportunities to our team members. It's a very people intensive business, and we are very focused about maintaining our values and culture across all our branches and offices.
So imagine if you were to go to sleep tonight, Arun, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Swasti is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Our vision is to make sure that we fulfill the right to finance for everybody irrespective of their income, right, or their circumstances. So just like, you know, we take it for granted that if we have, you know, middle, you know, if you look at anywhere in the developed world or say the affluent segments in even in a country like India, we take it for granted that we are all going to have access to finance. This is just taken as something that is absolutely, you know, for granted. But the reality is that for a vast majority of people in India and in the rest of the world, access to finance is not easily available at all. You know, maybe you and I can get credit cards. We can get, you know, car loans to buy, you know, automobiles. We can get home loans. We can get business loans. But if a person is poor, in this case, I'm talking about people who are making, say, $200-$300 per month income, right? These things can't be taken for granted. They are just not available. It's not that easy. It is also not economically viable for banks to service them. So there are, and also they are seen as vulnerable people who are not very good credit. So for all of these reasons, I would say that in a country like India, or there are at least 500, 600 million people who don't have access to finance, you know, the way the rest of the population has. And my goal is to make sure that this problem is addressed. And everybody, regardless of their income, should have access to finance and right to finance as a matter of right. And they should be able to access it that is proportionate to their income and their needs and their capacity. You know, it may be small needs and small capacities, but we must be able to provide this to them. So this is our vision, and this is what we want to accomplish.
So obviously, you know, incredible vision here. I want to talk about the past too with a lens of reflection. If I was to put you into a time machine and I was to bring you back in time, maybe to 2007, where you were thinking about giving up your career at the bank and starting something of your own. Imagine if, you know, right after that meeting that you had with Susan and Michael Dell, which got you thinking, if you had the opportunity of having a chat with your younger self and giving that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
So, well, I would say that, you know, the biggest challenge that that younger person would face is in raising capital. Because, you know, he was getting into a capital intensive business with absolutely no capital, right? So, you know, personally, at that stage, I didn't have access to any capital, neither did I have capital of my own. But ultimately, the raw material for my business is money. I got into it without, you know, sort of having a strong financial position personally, nor having access to large institutional support. So I think my advice would be to plan this a little better and make sure that you get much larger resources and access to, you know, capital secured earlier in the game than later. So I think this has been one of our largest, biggest challenges over the years. You know, we have been ready to scale to much higher levels than we are today. But throughout our journey, we have, you know, kind of struggled, you know, to raise as much capital as we wanted. Of course, we are on the verge of sort of resolving some of those challenges, but it's taken many, many years. You know, the industry itself has also been vulnerable, and it's been exposed to many big catastrophic events, you know, most recent of which being COVID. And prior to that, you know, certain legal regulatory transition time in India. So, you know, to navigate these sort of big challenges, if you're in the business of, you know, providing capital, you need to have access to a lot of capital. Yeah, I think that's what I would say. Yeah.
So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, look, you know, this is a commercial business. So if you are interested in exploring this further, you know, however you want to engage or explore, we are always open. You know, if you want to come and see how we work, visit any of our branches, look at our technology, you know, maybe work with us or, you know, help us raise money. We are open to, you know, any of these engagements from those who are, who have interest to pursue this. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, hey, Arun, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks a lot. And thank you for having me. And it's been fun having this discussion with you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.